This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable.
I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan and Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Daylight breaks over the ridge. The hounds strike. No crowds, no cameras, just a track and the hounds that bring the story to life. That's what this show's about. Dogs, dirt roads, early mornings, and the people who live it. This is Creekside Chronicles. Hounds, hunting, and heritage. I am your host, Heath Hyatt, houndsman, hunter, and a lifelong student of the outdoors. Here, we chase more than game. We chase knowledge about hounds, hunting, and living the outdoor life the right way. From bear country to back roads, this is where the hunt meets heart, and every story runs a different trail. So pull up your chair by the creek, leash up your best hound, and let's get after it together. Performance starts in the feed. Inukshuk's high-fat content fuels long runs and hard hunts, giving dogs the steady energy they need, while quality protein supports faster recovery after the work is done. That's why I trust Inukshuk dog food. Packed with energy and nutritious, dogs need to go further, run harder, and recover stronger. If you want extreme performance, you can look them up at Inukshuk Professional Dog Food or CoreyNutrition.com.
Today, we're going to travel out of Virginia. We're going to hit 81 south and travel south into Tennessee on 40, and we're going to take a dip down into Alabama. We're going to Auburn University. And we're going to have with us today the chief canine instructor for the university over their canine performance sciences program. And today's guest is going to be Bart Rogers. Bart, how is things in Alabama today?
Well, it's not as hot as they have been, but I'm pretty good.
I think we're getting some of your heat up here. Last 2 days, it was scorching yesterday. It was in high 80s. Today, it was 88. And, of course, I know y'all's humidity is probably worse than ours, but it has been difficult.
It's been, I think, a heat index of 102 to 104 the last week, and this week's finally cooled off, so we're actually been able to work some dogs.
Yeah, no, thank you. You can have your weather. I'll be ready for September and those cool fall evenings, mornings to roll around for me. Yeah. So, Bart, like I said, I can't even talk about all your accolades and what you do. So can you give the listeners just a rundown? If you want to tell us what you do, kind of what you're over, and then kind of give us a background on, on your dog life, basically, where you started, where you come from, what that meant.
Yeah. So, I've been at the university now, I think about 13 years. And just basically at the right place at the right time, got, part-time job going to school and, I was either working at a restaurant, bar, or, you know, some guy at the vet school was veterinary sports medicine. You run greyhounds and train bird dogs for minimum wage, and I thought that was a better idea. So I did that, and just, like I said, snowballed into now ending up being chief canine instructor for Auburn University Canine Performance Sciences Program for the breeding and development research side of our program. So basically, I've trained dogs primarily for foundationally prepared dogs. So I prepare them to go to the field to work. And I oversee the development of them from the time they're born, from in the nursery, early development, what we call them, and their intermediate development, and then which goes up to 6 months. And then we send them to prison, and inmates work with them, where they actually get an associate's degree in canine performance care and development. And I oversee that until, you know, they come back, and we slot dogs for research, which means they do odor research, if they say wash for slight environmental reasons, or they go into the field to work, and also help develop, implement, and employ the evaluations of these dogs at every time point, and assist in making breeding selections based on interpreting that data. But mainly we're geared to what I do is person-born IED, which is the patented vaporweight dog, that first patented dog that Auburn developed, and a little bit different than what you hear, passenger screen, things like that. And our breeding program, historically, you know, averages 80% success rate. So 80% of the dogs we produce, which is 60 to 80 dogs a year, we're not into filling everyone's need. This breeding program is to learn and to innovate and help, you know, small, even I'm involved in a breeding initiative, a consortium with small breeders and, you know, quality, not quantity, and help incentivize them and teach them how to be successful to produce dogs for national security, since we have a huge domestic shortage, which I'm pretty sure you understand that.
Yes.
And so basically, I oversee training development of dogs from the time they're born to they're sold in the field, and genetics and evaluation and breeding with that.
So
also just to add that, I also train dogs on observation, helped assist train and handle the first dogs, detect viruses. So in my job, I'm very lucky. I get to do a lot of things and a lot of novel odor detection research projects.
Yeah, just to make sure so the listeners understand. Basically, you're doing explosive detection work with the dogs you're raising. And 60 to 80 dogs, so you're looking at, you know, what, 6 to 10 litters a year?
I think we average, you know, 7 point something, but yeah, 6 to 8 litters a year.
Yeah. Okay. So, nice. And what's your, and I know you and I talked, but what is your, you know, what was your draw to dogs? What was your, you know, did you have them in your childhood? You know, did you?
Yeah. So unbeknownst to me, I grew up with dogs, and I thought it was a normal childhood. Didn't realize that it's different when you talk to most people. So our earliest memory of dogs is puppies was breeding red bones and had a litter of red bones. And we had a red bone female named Liz, and my granddad always had red bones. And if he didn't have red bones as coon dogs, he had tree and walkers and, you know, border collies. If they weren't the hound dogs, you were going to check cows or walk chickens in the chicken house, and the border collie went with you. I had breeding spaniels that we bird hunted with and experienced with some English pointers. And I had a bloodhound. Just list goes on. So thought that was normal. And like I said, at the right place at the right time, and took the job. And didn't know to me until Delmar Smith's son, Rick Smith, I was working with him, consulting with him, helping out with getting involved with breeding some detection dogs. And he pretty much told me, you have a unique background. And that was only about 2 years ago that moment happened, where he was like, you're where you need to be. You didn't just learn that here. Yeah. So that's why this intrigued me when you asked me my background with hound dogs. And it was, you know, as I go on, I try different breeds. I love, you know, I'm not just a lab guy. I love my Dutch Drawdyers. My favorite dogs are Spaniels. I love my English Cockers and English Springers. And, you know, I'm just up for trying new things and learning more about them. And hounds, given my background, always interest me. So when you asked me about this, I was like, heck yeah, this is, you know, I'm probably getting more out of this than you guys are.
The Spaniels, people don't realize they're working fools, aren't they?
Oh, well, let's just get this out there. The American Cocker is not an English Springer or American Springer. That is not the same thing. Mm-hmm. So when you get your hands on a English Springer and English Cocker, which 100-something years ago was the same breed, just people wanted larger ones for more of the upland birds and open fields versus Cockers that could they hunted woodcock and tight cover. Same breed, and they are working maniacs. And, yeah, that's the first time I got my hands on one was from Europe. And all these things we have to train some of these dogs to do and things, it was just there, like, instantly. Like, this, anybody can do this.
Natural ability.
They are working machines.
So let's go. We talk about natural ability. Let's go back to your hounds real quick because you and I kind of touched on it. So unique. What was unique back then about your hounds that, you know, that you're seeing now that it's not so much the same?
It's kind of a progression of everything is, you know, when I started my career is everything was when dog training, especially this, when you got into the, everything was fancy. You had to have all these like high end techniques and gadgets and know all this. And, you know, and I was like, you know, and then you kind of step back and it's like, man, those Britneys I had or those hound, I don't remember doing any, all this fancy stuff to get them to do, to point birds or to tree a raccoon. Like, you know, they just had experience. If there was an old dog, they ran with it. If not, you just put them in areas where they eventually got it. You got it right. Like, that's what this is about. Mm-hmm. And, it, you know, there wasn't any training. And I kind of, as I evolved in my training, now I believe the more fancy equipment and more fancy techniques, the further you're getting away from real dogs and real training, the more it's simple and the more it's about the quality of dog and its capabilities and the right scenarios. You know, that's where it's at. And that's what I, you know, I thank God I had that background growing up in Northeast Alabama and was did not knowing it till now is just that, yeah, we didn't train dogs. And a friend of mine is Craig Koshett wrote some of the book on the upland breeds. And he talks about a story where the Spanish with their Spaniels and went and they were encountered the Europeans, the Germans, and they were training their dogs. And they just thought, how odd was it that these guys have to train their dogs? They just, you know, they selected dogs every time that do better job than what they wanted done before. They just didn't know why they had to train their dog.
Yeah.
And that's my experience when you select dogs that have the right traits. It's very minimal work if you know what you need for the job.
It's just providing opportunity.
Yeah, the scenario to learn what needs to learn.
Yep, and that's why we have you on here. So let's dive into it. So. Let's start with your breeding program. One thing that I want to touch on during our conversation is your selection process about how you select dogs to breed, what draws you to those certain dogs. So let's talk about your breeding program and let's just get right in and talk about your selection. And then I want to talk to you a little bit about line breeding and outcrossing. So I'll let you take it from there.
So I'll just give you my experience here, and by no means am I a theriogenologist, and, you know, I'm not confirmation breeder and all of this, and I know my pedigrees for labs, for work, for especially attention work, but I'm not going to sit here and rattle off names and, you know, full names of stuff. I'm not that guy. Mm-hmm. So my experience with this and what we've learned is, what I've learned is, and how we evolved at Auburn was, we made progress real quick by putting we got our genetics donated to us basically from Australian Customs, which would be British labs. We got them back here and they were good. And this was right after 9/11, you know.
Yep, that's when a boom come. Yep.
Very little dog work, anything, no detection dogs basically yet. And now we have person born IED issues, we have all this and like dogs are still it. That's the only thing that can compare to capable tool to find this detection capability. So, but no one had the dogs. No, I mean, the labs in this country, they, you know, there was a few duck dogs. It wasn't like now every 12-year-old, 13-year-old boy has a direction controlled Labrador retriever. That didn't exist then. And there, you know, it wasn't a huge world. So they donated the genetics, but they're a little too soft when you say, and I'm not saying to pressure correction, just resilient to stress. When it got hard, they could back off. Mm-hmm. So we took some of the American field line and crossed it in and gave it some backbone. And then we had to figure out how to keep it together. It wasn't just getting it on the ground in this quality thing. We put some jet fuel on it with the American hunt test field trial line. We had to develop it to it was what we wanted. It wasn't a basket case at the end, but wasn't a pet, you know? Mm-hmm. So we started out playing around and we fostered them out, and we had about a 90% washout rate. And looking back now at what we know, we should have kept those few that were vaporweight dog quality or high-end quality dogs at the end. And that should have been what we bred. But instead, we swapped and we said, let's put them in prisons. We had a 90% success rate. So we structured once we got some backbone in these dogs. And that persisted, people doing repeat breedings. Oh, this dog throws good dogs. But there was no fault of – it was just this dog has this pedigree and he's good. And this dog throws good dogs. Let's put them together. But as threats change, as you know, it wasn't, you know, constantly the threat changes. And it's not just you need to adapt with it and what these dogs need to be capable of doing and what, you know, just move things around a little bit. How to have a better understanding, because 5 years ago, the procurement test for a Labrador Retriever was, okay, they're not really scared that bad of anything. They got good reward value. They'll hunt. I want it. Now they have no self-preservation to the point that if you leave them outside for 10 minutes, they probably killed themselves because what people should say in evaluation is fear is actually keeping them alive. But we bred that out of them because they have to be in Times Square New Year's Eve. And so we constantly had to make these selections. And the only thing was not just be good and produce some dogs. It's how do you get 80% or strive to get 100%. How do you get 6 out of 8, 7? And how do you gap that to get 7 or 8 out? Get these 100% litters, and not 100% litters that'll sell, 100% that are the same.
Consistency. You know,
this dog's got a good on and off switch. He's clear headed. He's stable with all the drive in the world, with no anxiety or unproductive arousal. You know, he's transitioned to handlers. Green handlers can handle him. It doesn't take an expert. He's not too much dog. They can do everything but forgiving. How do you get that, and how do you get it consistently? Because that was the game. Once you know it's possible, which we did, now how do you replicate it time and time again and make genetic progress? So, you know, that's kind of – I may be getting a little further ahead.
No, teach us.
This is just a thought process. This is not a how. This is the thought process where we went, and – you know, it was more of looking into not just that dog. It's that dog, it's litter mates, it's sire, and it's dam. And, you know, you deem a litter and then select the breeder. And then if it's just a one-off dog, so say you've got 8 in a litter and 5 of them are good, and then you got 1 complete washout, and then you got 1 phenomenal dog, I would go, or, you know, we need to question this. Let's really look at this. Or if you've got, say, you know, 1 dog that's phenomenal, best dog you've ever seen, but he has 7 litter mates that are complete washes, I would never breed that dog. But that was happening before this point that we looked at this. It was just, this dog's great. No, nothing around it other than that pedigree is great. But what was litter mates? Because I've experienced dogs that are great, but they do not throw the genetics of what they are. Mm-hmm. You know, kind of like the Secretariat thing, which is not a true story. But like the references, Secretariat did this, but he never threw anything like him. Well, that dog, those one-off dogs are probably development. Nature versus nurture, like that. Mm-hmm. You know, people may have given them exactly what they needed and the luck of having it at the exact right time that made this amazing dog, but it will not repeat. If you breed that dog and you don't have the right kennels, the same production model and kennels and seasonality, the region and temperature and things like that can have a major effect on it. So what we want to breed dogs is that they're resilient and they're consistent. And, you know, I'll stop there and let you ask more questions exactly which way you want this to go of how we got that consistency.
I'm sitting here in my mind trying to log them. So I want to back up just for a second and mm-hmm. make sure that we understand what you're saying, mm-hmm. which I think most people do. So if you have a litter of 7 puppies mm-hmm. and you have five of the seven that are that perform and do what you're asking them to do, and you have two, maybe you have two oddballs or whatever, then that is a litter that you would pick a breeder from.
Yeah, say I had seven, I have one complete washout, don't know what went wrong, five, they're pretty good, and then one phenomenal, I'd be like, and depending where you start, you know, if you're advanced in your breeding program and you're just, you know, you're making tweaks, but if you're really getting started and making progress, you know, pick what you want. What's progress? Five good dogs and one phenomenal dog and one wash, that's progress. That tells me that I'm hedging my bets on what I see in that best dog or genetics and not development. Because in my experience of development, it's like 400 or 500 puppies now or somewhere close to that, however breeding program is, you don't get 5 out of 8 to look the same or one phenomenal just based on the luck of development. But doesn't typically work that way. So you're hedging, what you're trying to do is be structured enough and then objective enough in the way that you look at it is that am I picking the genetics or am I picking a random luck? May not be that one-off dog, but if I'm going to casino, let's play blackjack. You know, let's not play roulette here. And let's, you know, there we can make some calculated decisions here. If that many are that way, I would have to bet that a lot of this are genetics and genetics that interact with my training protocol, my kennels, and my production. So we want that, get that, that's progress. Now, if you're pairing those dogs with something, what do you pair it with? Do I take this high-end male that is a Ferrari and say, I'm going to go find a female that's a Ferrari that came from the same composition, good litter, breeding quality, consistent litter, and pick that, and I take the Ferrari and I pair it with the Ferrari.
Now, are these are these line bred or are these outcrossed?
Good question. So first, I would just say without the line bred and outcrossed is putting two things that are high end or the same exact dog without pedigree, just same characteristics, high end. That you're going to push the, and we did it. And in first year, you're going to think that, wow, I'm making progress. And all of a sudden, you're going to take the dog, push the gas pedal to somewhere that it's not productive, not great. You'll have sports cars and nobody knows how to drive. And if you take them out to drive and work, you got to put them in the shop for a little while. And nobody else has the expertise to handle them. So what we did is say complimentary. What does this dog bring to the table with its consistently litter and traits that are not deficiencies, but attributes? Like, what is its positive traits, phenotypic traits? You know, is it its reward value? Is it its air scenting? But this dog may have a little higher arousal. As he works and gets rewarded, he kind of gets amped up, but he doesn't ever calm back down. They're able to regulate their body temperature and handle the heat and environmental factors. Environmentally sound, but then this dog over here may be not have the anxiety that we mentioned, a little unproductive, is calm, cool, collected, maybe a little less reward value. And this female, say that was the male we're talking about, this jet fuel over here, but comes with some unproductive arousal, you know, slight anxiety and things like that. This female has none of that, but she may lack the reward value. But this dog's over the top for his reward value and possession for the ball. But I would put them together and complement. I wouldn't exacerbate these traits to the point that
yes, you can't handle them. Right.
Crazy. Yep. Yeah, they're crazy animals. So it's always an offset where you're making progress, but you're not going in a territory nobody wants where you've created this just off-the-wall monster. And also, I'm putting more of the emphasis on the female for some of the later back traits because she's got to be able to deal with puppies in a nursery that are looking at her. And if she's stressed out because she's not working, what does that mean for them? She may have been great because her mother was different from her handler, but breeding with a male, the female, she's too high. Now you breed them and she's anxious all the time wanting to work and not to take care of these puppies. But now they're anxious and that manifests itself as environmental unsoundness. Now they're all scared. Even though she wasn't, they weren't. So it's like, what the heck? These things happen. You're like, what the heck's going on? So you've got to pick things for traits and offset. It's not you pick the identical thing. These are Ferraris. These are high-end things and put them together. What do you want out of the female? What do you want of the male? How did you pick your female and male based on the litter? And did you do, you know, what traits, what do they have in them? And then we'll get to your question is, and why are they there? If they're genetic, we know they're genetic. What genetic traits created that behavior? Because in some lines, say you're saying line breeding, right? Inbreeding coefficient's higher, right?
Yep.
Some
yep.
people say inbred. Line breeding is not inbred.
No, correct. Let's establish that. Yeah. Outcross would be no kin in the pedigree.
Mm-hmm. No relation.
Yep. Line breeding would be there is family members somewhere in the 3 to 5 mm-hmm. generation, and then mm-hmm. Line breeding would be basically incest: brother, sister, dad, daughter, yep. mom, son, so on and so forth. So yep. that would be our 3 crosses, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And in line breeding, there's no risk of the medical defect, anything like that. When it comes to inbreeding, it's perfectly safe. It's fine. I mean, you're from the south, I'm from the south, you know, past third cousin, you know, whatever. I'm joking. But but seriously, what happens is that even within a breed, say you're outcrossing, even within a breed, you can have lines of dogs. So a Labrador Retriever from South Georgia versus a Labrador Retriever from Minnesota. They're both Labrador Retrievers. But pedigree-wise, genetic-wise, they're completely different dogs. And they may exhibit the same behaviors you say you like, but the genetic code, I'm not a geneticist, the genetics that make those behaviors expressed that we see are completely different than make them up. Complete combination of genetics that make that come about. So when you if you take these outcrosses, you may capture 1 or 2 dogs that has this balance of things you need, but they won't be the whole litter.
Mm-hmm.
So if you increase that inbreeding coefficient, so say you take a female that you want complementary with this Ferrari male to offset and create nice litters, and your inbreeding coefficient is elevated, and because they're related, then the consistency of what you get and that mixture of what you want. We always talk about you don't get 50-50, right? Mm-hmm. You don't put them together and get 50-50. But you can get closer to getting 50-50 with that. And the outcrossing would be when I'm trying to capture a trait I want. I want to say I'm kind of getting bottlenecked in my genetics. Say you only have 4 or 5 breeders, 6 breeding individuals. You got to be real careful that you don't get to the point you're inbreeding, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to outcross. So when you outcross and be calculated. What is an outcross that has a trait that I want, that I really want to capture?
Yep.
Then you outcross, you grab that trait. I did it. Hey, this is Labs at Auburn. I got some number 18, 116, Dutch Drawdyer. Probably not Veeran Dutch Drawdyer because we were able to purchase him out of Serbia. So I think we figured out he's 1 centimeter too tall to be bred.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted heavy Arison and Projo. So we crossed him in. But we crossed him back. And when we crossed him back to the lab, we made sure, or tried now, knowing what we do it a little bit different, and increase that inbreeding coefficient. We capture what we want, and then make sure that what we want is now consistently and through the litter, and they're consistent. Instead of the highly variable, well, you go highly variable, capture what you want, but be calculating what you want when you outcross and adding to your genetic diversity.
So that's a cross where I really need to do my research and look at be open-minded and look at different dogs to decide mm-hmm. what's going to bring the most value to my breeding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is it? What trait? And you know, this is what we need to talk about. And this is like, what are you looking for? And like, you go, what trait am I improving? And try to come up with terms. Like, what is it? So like for my dogs, I'm looking at performance side, which is all the hunt and reward and all that. And then I'm looking at environmental stability, right? And then there's a medical side of it. Someone else handles that. You know, that's the one that I always have to argue because all the dogs that I want end up having a little medical thing. And it's a baby with a bathwater argument all the time.
Yeah.
But medical's important. And when I'm looking for the performance, I'm looking for hunt. How do they efficiently and innately investigate their environment? And that is separated from odor. If there's no odor involved, are they actively out, naturally driven to hunt, investigate their environment? Air scenting, when they hit odor, how efficiently can they work odor to source and utilize the air in the odor and interpret it? And efficiently, I'm looking at arousal when working. When they hit odor, do they speed up and their mouth goes open, or do they slow down and close and efficient?
I'm looking for, like I said, reward value, their possession, for the ball, so I can manipulate them to find odors that mean nothing to a dog, or especially a Labrador Retriever. And then I'm looking for things of task engagement, handler engagement. Are they, you know, if the dog's low in task engagement, when I remove the ball from his mouth, is I have to beg him to go back to work, or do I remove it? Does he automatically go back to work? And if I have low task engagement and high handler engagement, then that means that I have a handler cue dog. He can't do anything but stare at me, and I have to beg him to do something. If I have a high task engagement and high handler engagement, then I'm saying, hey, I've got the unicorn here. He'll do anything I want him to do in detail, and I can cast him here, and just he wants to please me. But this son of a gun doesn't need me when I'm not involved. He is hunting his butt off on his own and working.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all these things. And I say, what you're looking for in your dog, give it a name. What is it? And try to, with the people you're working with, also give a name. That's what I see in the detection dog where I'm at the same. You're going to go, oh, watch this dog this. And what the heck is that? Oh, you're saying this. Try to get on the same page and have the same terms. So when y'all are talking about breeding dogs and everything, y'all know
what it is you're looking for.
What I'm looking for. Yeah, it's not like, well, I didn't know that's what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And I'm not an academic. I'm not going to sit here and science this up. But the only way to make real progress is to be objective. You have to sit back and go, this is not my opinion. Like, if a dog is hunt, say I give him a 1 to 5 scale and I'm going to score my own hunt when I'm evaluating. I evaluate him at 3, 5, 10, and then post 16 days of training after 10 months, I formally put them into some odor work and then reassess them. I say for hunt, I have a 1 is dog, this dog won't hunt. You know, if I'm moving around, he never investigates anything. A 2 is like sporadically, very rare, he'll engage in investigating something in his environment.
Mm-hmm.
3, he engages for periods of time, stops. 4, he engages for prolonged periods of time, but without any finding anything, he may diminish or stop periodically. 5, this son of a gun is investigating his environment, and not only is he investigating constantly, he is doing it in an efficient, calculated manner. It's natural. And I sit and I score those things out, and it is not my opinion, and it's not my reference to the last litter. It is my reference to what do I consider the ultimate level, the best and the worst of hunt.
Mm-hmm. So,
and
go ahead.
And the same thing for environmental soundness is I look at reaction recovery. Mm-hmm. Do they react? Do they recover?
Yep.
So if I do, say, acoustic startle, visual startle. So say you're going to fire a 12 gauge off around your shepherd and you're buying it. It's like, hey, let's see how he handles this. You know, you fire it off and you go, a 1 would be he pancaked or he hit the end of the leash and he's 3 counties away by the time you catch up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's never going to that area again or getting in your car again because it was just that bad. No recovery. A 2 would be, wow, that was a bad reaction with some encouragement and a lot of work. He recovered in that moment. A 3 would be reaction and slightly, hey, boy, that's okay. He stood back up. Oh, we're good. You said it was good. A 4 would be he heard it. He reacted, instantly took it upon himself to recover on his own. A 5, you go, he's dead. What happened here? He didn't even hear that.
Yeah.
Didn't care. So, and I score all these dogs on that. Every time I evaluate them, everybody's like, oh, it takes tons of time. No, it doesn't. It doesn't take any more time than it does if you're doing this, you know, yourself. Like, you're doing this. It's just most people don't have a way.
You're just not writing it down.
Writing it down, and you can't remember. You can't. You say, oh, this dog. And you go back and look, and like, yeah, that's not right. And another thing is, people picking the dog at the very end. And that's where I learned that you can't remember. This dog's amazing. I love this dog. Then you look through his history and be like, that is not. That was, this dog struggled his whole life. I just remember at the very end. I had an incident with a dog. This dog's name was Mr. Linderman. It was named after somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I selected a dog out of a litter named Merle. And Merle was phenomenal, flashy, showy. And during the eval where I was selling him as a vaporweight dog, there was another group in Fort McClellan was evaluating him. This chocolate lab, and Dr. Wagner was with me, Paul Wagner, he's the director of program, was with me. This dog just keeps excelling at all these crazy startles, like stuff that 99.9% of dogs just couldn't handle. I don't care what breed. If they were not working and developed for this, they just couldn't handle it. And on top of surviving this gauntlet of things, he walks out the door and there's someone with a 12 gauge that shoots over him. And he's just like, hey, I heard that. What are you doing? Let's go work. And after all of this, Dr. Wagner's looking at me going, what the heck? Which dog we breed? We breed him? No. Well, So I go back and look, and I print out all the evals and his progression chart of his evaluations over time, and I didn't put their names on them. And I have a chart of how his it was on a daily basis in training and everything, and then his eval scores. And I said, think about consistency and progression over time when you look at these and pick the best dog. I just told people who walked in the office that knew something about training dogs experience, and they all picked the same dog. Well, Merle, who I'd picked at the end, it was the best dog you ever seen, Ferrari, but was no emphasis on his whole life and how he got there and not looking back. Washed. He went to a professional baseball game, was working, and pyrotechnics went off, and he never worked again. Mr. Lindy's still in the field. I don't know how old he is. I think he's 8, 9, 10 years old at this point. He's still working, and I picked the wrong dog. So that was my point, my change point of looking at these evaluations, knowing your genetic breeding dog, not look at what the end goal is. Look at how it got there.
I think we talk about this is, you know, we call this the podcast The Journey because it's a process. Mm-hmm. Like,
oh, yes.
You don't, you know, you can't, you have to look at the whole picture and not just one, mm-hmm. one slide. So that's very good. But I want to go back when you were talking about, you know, the traits that you're looking for. So, you know, and everybody in the hound world is a little different. I mean, the guys out west, it's cat hunting, are looking for a little bit different stuff than what the guys out east are bear hunting. And, I want a dog that,
well, explain to me within that. How does that differ? Is the cat dogs, are they more? Are they like the English pointers that, the ones that, you know, have flushing dogs that come up with them? You know, that you catch up with them 5 miles later, they're still on point. They're just wide range and opened up dogs versus English pointers that hunt woodcock and retrieve to the antler. You know, are they more closer working dogs? What are the traits? I'm intrigued. This is what I do. What traits differentiate those hounds? The differences.
So. And I'm not a cat hunter. I don't have a line hound. Mm-hmm. I've been out to mm-hmm. and dry ground hunted in New Mexico a couple times. So mm-hmm. you cat guys don't shoot the messenger. I'm just ad-libbing here.
So I do this all the time. Yeah. I'm not speaking for you, but
yeah. So I mean, from what I see and the guys that I talk to and that I know, they have to have a dog. It depends if you're hunting north or south too. If they're dry ground mm-hmm. hunting, they got to have mm-hmm. a dog that'll settle down on a track and trail a track up that may take, days.
Because that dry ground is harder for the odor to last. They're going to have to pay more attention, you're saying, from the dry ground, so the dog needs to be slower, more methodical?
Yes. I would say, yes.
Okay. They can't be fast and overrun and make mistakes because it's harder to keep up with the track given
yes.
the temperature and how it affects odor. Okay.
Yep. And then
– makes perfect sense.
If I'm writing a list on the things that I want in a dog, mm-hmm. I want a dog that can trail, which means I don't want the dog standing on his head. I want him to be able to move the odor as needed. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've picked up from my canine training that I've learned a lot, and you mentioned it, Cameron mentioned it, is a dog that does not exert energy when he don't need to. You know, yeah. I want a dog that when you flip efficient. The light switch, okay, let's go to work. I want that dog that's in a calm mind. Mm-hmm. So I want a dog that can trail, and I want a dog that can move that track accordingly. If it's an older track and it takes him some time, then work it out. But when that track gets mm-hmm. to moving, I need you to start moving with it. I don't need you standing on your head.
So you're saying from what I would say is a dog that follows football dead track, it'd be hard for him to catch up. You want a dog to throw a nose up and trail and take the cues from drifts of odor and doesn't have to be dead on the track, but he can get from point A to point B.
Yes, and once he gets there.
He can deduce and dead reckon and make a lot of decisions and get there fast.
Correct. I want him, yes. Once he gets there, he's got to have good mm-hmm. running speed. I want him mm-hmm. to catch the game, which means mm-hmm. I prefer my dogs to run with their head in the air. Just what you just said.
Air send trailing dog.
Yep. And after it gets jumped.
Dog.
Yep. Yep. Just after it gets jumped. And then I want them to have enough grit. Now, they don't have to be no kamikaze. I don't like my dogs getting tore up. I don't like them getting cut up and beat up. But they need to stay with a bear. That means if they need to stay and bark at it for 5 hours until I get there, then I need you to stay and bark at it. Don't come back. Don't quit. Stay with it.
Don't be
don't be 40 feet up the tree either when I get there.
I hate a tree climber.
I've not experienced it, but I can imagine that. I love that you're talking about this, because one thing I haven't noticed you do, and it's great, is you haven't said drive one time, because what you're doing is parsing you. What's your drive? What's this person's drive for this dog? What do they want in them? And you're saying it, and that's what I'm liking, is like you've not once said drive. I hate it, because there's a two-way street. It's motivation, arousal. Well, what type of mixture that you need for what your target is?
Right.
You know, you could say for this dog, he needs to have more, but you don't want that dog that's over greedy to the point that he's endangering himself if you're not there fast enough, because he has no self-preservation and he's got too much prey drive. He's not even thinking about himself and gets there.
And that's nothing but vet bills. That's $1,000, $1,500 every time he gets caught. I mean, that's what it is. I want him to stay treat. If they tree the game, I want him to stay with it. And they have to have a good temperament. That's very important when you're hunting with a pack of hounds. I don't need a dog that is growly, is ornery. Here's the two-edged sword. To hunt big game, it takes a little bit of tenacity to get that game to climb. So I'm asking my dog that, hey, I need you to put enough pressure on this animal to make him climb or keep him there until I get there. But in the same sense, I don't want you fighting with the other dogs.
Exactly. So that's impressive to me. So this is interesting. So, and on top of that, I hear you guys want them to sound a certain way too. These are, you know, when I say, oh, what we do is a whole lot of different phenotypes that we have to capture. We have to get them all dialed in right to get these perfect dogs. You're in a different venue, but that's a lot right there. You're asking a dog to have that much prey drive and that intensity to continue on with that and want to be there and be legitimate enough to that animal think, I might need to go up the tree. Wait a minute, I'm a 500-pound bear. What am I running these hound dogs for? Yep. You know, you're asking that of it, but not get frustrated and maul the dog next to it because we're getting in competition. Mm-hmm. That's impressive.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a lot of other things. There's little things that we can add to that. You know, the arousal over the lack of scent. I like a dog that gives good mouth. You just said that. You said you like them to sound. I don't care if my dog's ball mouth, chop mouth. I could care less at this point in my life. But I really...
Is it consistent?
Yes, consistent. I want a dog that when he gets scent in his nose, that he's aroused enough to let me know, hey, Dad, I got it right here. And then Dad can, you know, I can either turn him off the truck if we're rigging, which is kind of what your vapor wake is, and we can explain that to everybody. Or if I'm down free casting, which means I'm just walking through the woods and we're walking through an oak patch, and, you know, they go over there and they start smelling, you know, I want them to open to tell me the story of what's going on.
Yeah, you could read it just like I read a dog working. I've trained dogs for pythons and everything, but in the dog, I could tell you that dog is smelling one way out and across a python across the glades, and I can't get to him. Move on. That dog's telling me that this one had laid here, but it's no longer here. Or, hey, this was just here, and we might be about to get on a track, you know, or we're about to find something. Just by reading his behavior, you're doing that by communication. When he's on something like, oh, he might have something. Oh, that's getting more. Yeah, he's on it. You know, like you're reading that, but he has to be clear and consistent in what he's communicating with you to do that. And that, I mean, we're all speaking the same language, just different way here.
So Bart, help us. Okay, let me give you, I'll give you an example, and maybe you can roll off this. So I just had a litter of puppies. Mm-hmm. They're 5 months old. Mm-hmm. I'll give you some background on them, and then I'll get your opinion. So we did exactly what you just talked about. We did a complementary breeding. Mm-hmm. There is no kin in the backgrounds. The male dog that I have is 1/8 of a running dog, 1/8 running dog. So I got my speed. He's got really good grit. He has tight mouth on the track. So mark that down as my little thing. He's tight mouth on the track.
Does that mean that he's quiet?
Yes.
Quieter.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. He does not. Okay. I would prefer him to be more open. Okay. He's got good grit, good speed, and stick. Like you're going to catch him off of it, or he's going to stay with it till you get there. So some of the things that I just talked about, he checks those boxes. Yeah. And we all know that no dog's perfect.
Mm-mm. That's why, you know, you're doing this complimentary. Well, what if you get it perfect? No. That will never happen. Right. When we do, I'm done.
So, yeah. So we bred a female who is a little bit bigger than I would like as a female. She's a bigger female, but she gets down. She's good open mouth, and she trails good. She moves the track really well. Good tree dog, very good natured. Her flaw is that when she jumps, which means they trail the bear till it's up and actually moving now. So they've got it up and they're moving it. She does not pick her head up to run. She bobs that head. So it slows her down in her speed. Does that make sense?
She'll tell you exactly where it walked, but she ain't going to catch up to it.
Well, she will. It just takes her longer to do it.
Not as efficient as it could be.
Right. So
she's putting a lot more effort into it than needs to be.
Correct. So we bred those two dogs, and I have a litter of puppies. I got six puppies. They are 5.5 months old as of tomorrow, Saturday. Or no, they'll be 5.5 months old here in a couple days. We have done the environmental stuff. I've done a lot of stuff what I do with my police dogs, and these dogs show a lot of the stuff that we want to see at a very early age, and I'm going to ask you about that with your pups too. We see a lot of stuff. So I got six pups, and this is the second litter that's out of him. The other litter is out of him, is a year and a half old, and at the same age of the last litter to the same age as this litter, there is consistency. Complete two outcrosses.
Yeah,
so
and
Build me a breeding program. What do I do to make my stuff better?
So what I hear, you're seeing a male that has completely outcrossed, and you have another litter out of him, and you're seeing those quality traits, right?
Correct.
So you have two litters out of this male, complementary breeding, different dam, and this is different dam, right? It's not two different breedings of the same
dam. And I will let me talk about the first dam real quick.
Yeah.
She has a lot of his traits. She's open mouth, which we wanted. She's probably a little too gritty. She gets some holes in her more than we would like. We see the pups out of that litter are a little bit more tenacious. She trails good, has good speed and stay power. So there's a lot of stuff in there. The only two differences in that first breeding was she gives good mouth on the ground, off the truck, where he does not. Okay. Everything up kind of matches up. So go.
So you complimentary where your one dog was weak and didn't do what you wanted. You tried to offset it with a male in both instances. With your second female, you know, she was head down on the ground and not arising as much as he was head up, and offset that. And he was quiet where she was loud. I think you're on the right track. And I think, you know, as we talked about deeming a dog from a litter's quality, and you starting this and breeding in two different females, and they're completely different outcrosses. Okay, you may get some variability, but there's also instances that I've seen with males. Especially the females, the hard part. The hardest part of the game is females. In my world, is to find a good female is hard. The males, I can go find around and get semen, but the females, if somebody's got one, they're not going to let you breed it, bring it to your house and breed it. You know, that's not typically how it works. And so I would say you sound like you've got a male that's demonstrating that he will throw his genetics, and he will be expressed in their behavior. And the outcross is not that significant, you know, and maybe that's just somewhat the hound world. You know, I don't know it that well enough, but I've had dogs. I got a dog right now I go get, and I always tell people I can put him on a house cat and I get some vaporweight dogs out of litter. And it just, he's that strong in what he throws. And, so what I would say is, from starting your breeding program, is that you got one male, you got two females, right?
I own neither female. These are guys that hunt with me,
you're going to get litters out of. So you've got these litters out of them.
Got two.
Now you've got one stud, and you've got litters on the ground, right?
Correct.
So I'd say my first priority is to get to keep female. That would be the way I'd look at it. Now I need the best female out of here. And what am I looking for in her? I'm looking for maternal care. I don't know what that is out of female. I imagine
hunting dogs that have that much tenacity mm-hmm. and prey drive, you got to be careful how they're with puppies, mm-hmm. like you would be with Malinois and Shepherds. But I would also say that, you know, now you need to be going and find where's, you know, your outcross, but you know the pedigrees of them. Okay, now which one are you leaning to now that you got your mixture and you got your outcrosses? You may see some variability now, but you've selected the ones that really got what you want, say a female and a male. Or maybe you didn't want the males out of this and you really like how it worked out and the females, you got your male here. Now I'm going to keep these two females. I need to go find the males of different blood or more related bloodlines of which one we either the sire or the dam they're crossed with that yields you more of what you want and say, I've got what I want in this female. Now let's cross it back, or two females, and let's cross it back with that and see if we can't solidify those traits and to get more consistency through the litter if you're seeing some inconsistency, which you should. If they're complete outcrosses, you should see some that like, that one's a carbon copy of the mother, that's a carbon copy of the dad. But really what I was trying to do was get a mixture where the one where the deficiencies of are all covered, where she contributed, they hit all the marks and made progress to mm-hmm. improve and enhance the traits that I want in those areas. So it's a good mixture of them. I would take that good mixture and try to determine which relation I'm going to breed it back with and not do another complete outcross, because you got what you want, hopefully. Now, cross it back with something that's going to solidify that through a larger number of dogs. I'm not saying breed it back so much later till you're going to get 7 out of 8 or consistent. It may take 2 generations, 3 generations. And then you're having to offset inbreeding. So you're having to constantly outcross in genetic diversity, but be calculated and know how to solidify and increase consistency. So if I'm got enough and I'm selling dogs to people, I don't like, he's got good hound dogs, but be careful which ones you pick. You need to really look at them. I would be like, hey, you know, it's damn dime's bit of difference between the best one and the worst one is what I'd want to be. And I would be telling them, this is this tier level dog. This is this tier level dog. What are you looking for? And pick either one of them. You want a male, want a female? You know, unless you're running competitions, there's not probably, you're not going to tell the difference in them.
Yeah. And I'm completely with you, but I want to recap what you just said. Mm-hmm. So I've got 2 litters on the ground out of 2 different females, mm-hmm. same sire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a half brother to that sire.
Mm-hmm.
Some different traits. So a lot of the mm-hmm. same traits, some different traits. One thing I forgot to add with the male dog that I think is mm-hmm. important for the listeners is Spook was a very weak tree dog at a young age. He's 3 now, but at a year mm-hmm. old, if the leaves were on, he didn't hardly tree. He'd run to the tree and that's it. And after the first season and the leaves come off and he realized everything was going up above his head. And that was both something that I added when we made the first cross too, is she was a really good tree dog. All right. So
is that something that's typical? Like the leaves may be off so they can actually see, oh, it's up there above me, this thing moving, and they put the picture together. Is that
he was a weak tree dog at a young age.
Okay.
He is not mm-hmm. now, like completely mm-hmm. different dog at 3 than he, mm-hmm. like you said, that process, that development, but mm-hmm. that was worrisome when we done this, and I wanted to make sure that the female was a good tree dog, and she was, and the pups are phenomenal. So I've got 2 litters, I've got mm-hmm. a half brother to the sire. Do I breed a female out of each litter to? Do I crossbreed the litters, or would you go with breeding to the half brother?
So, I mean, if you stay within the realms of the inbreeding coefficients, it's not actually inbreeding, it's line breeding, mm-hmm. then, and I would say that you got traits of him and that one, you got traits in the sire and his half brother, and you're leaning towards that, and you've got the hard tree out of her, and you think she's carrying that genetically. It's not a developmental thing that you just experienced and what hard work got there. I would say crossing back with that half brother, and I mean, what's the worst case scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they would wash. I mean, I could be wrong, mm-hmm. but I don't think they would, but that would be the worst thing that happens.
Yeah, and I would think is, you know, you've got those genetics and now you're going into relation and you're getting up there in consistency, and it would, worst case scenario, you get a little more variability if you wanted to, and you didn't get that, you know, locking it in and making it consistent in that cross. But I don't think it's going to go downhill. I mean, the big question is in the half brother to him, you know, was the sire that much different to that half brother than the, you know, the sire you're using? And look at that and just know who he is and how different is he in bloodlines. But I would think that, yes, that would be the exact thing I would do. And it's not a dead thing that this is going to work, because you can have some dogs and you can be calculated as you can in this. Mm-hmm. And there's some dogs that just, I don't know what it is, they do not throw. But I will tell you, you're hedging your bets with this type of philosophy. So without us having be able to take a sample of a dog and pop it in a machine and say, yes, he has genetics, which doesn't really exist yet, this is the only way I know that made progress. And this is what people's been doing, whether they knew it or not. It's just, you, like you said, this whole outcrossing thing is that you do outcrossing, increase variability to the chances you get exactly what you want, and then you don't continue to do that because you just have variability every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, if I hope I'm saying this, we're understand it is, and it makes sense to people, is yes, I would cross. I would cross it back at that, unless you know one that is related to your sire, maybe it's not, and it's a better dog and gives you that same relation to try to attempt to solidify and get consistency once you capture what you want. That'd be the only reason, but I don't see what it would hurt.
Yeah. And just so you know, the half brother, they're out of the same dads, different mothers.
Different mothers. Okay. Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Different mothers is what okay. They're out of. And like I said, there's the weakness of the brother. Right, and he's not even 2 years old yet, okay? So he's nowhere near a finished dog. He's got excellent speed. He's a really hard tree dog, which was not what Spook was. My deficiency with him right now is staying with a mean bear. If it's a walking bear, he stays. But if that bear goes to chasing dogs and running them off, he's left two. I mean, he's left two of them. And that's a concern. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot. I mean, we get a handful a year. But at the same time, I want him to stay. I don't want
him to leave. Yeah, you cross the line, he's too smart.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's like, yeah, I don't want this.
But and that's where you need to, like I said, be structured in your development of your dogs and, you know, and what you do and try to say, I do this. I know you can't do everything exactly the same, but you have an idea of your process and be able to identify what's going on and say, you know, is that dog weak or is this dog strong the way you went for based on the experience he's had and they were perfect and did everything right? And is this dog you said is bugging out on a bear that decides to chase him, is it because of genetics or is it because early on he had a bad experience, probably too long that he was mature enough to deal with, yep. And it was extreme, you know, bad scenario. It can happen. Like, I can have the best litter and then have, like, man, when this dog was working odor, the air brakes went off and it hurt it, and then all of a sudden someone tripped and fell on it, or, you know, just a series of things, and that became a very traumatic experience during a critical window of development. And you have to document and say, well, yeah, that one's that way, but we're kicking this side because this is outside the normal realm. This is a bad thing. Is that what caused that? So being able, and sometimes you can never know, but if it's a one-off, that'll tell you it probably is. So if he's just that way and nothing around him is that, you know, and just being able to track, and trying to get underneath and see what's genetic, what is development and experience, so you can know when you make a decision what, if it's genetic or not.
Yeah.
And that's just like, you know, and it, like, I'm with you. Like, with, do you have litter mates around him, or people have them?
I have some connections with some guys that have, yes, I have connection with some, not with the brother, but the sire. And I also have a female that is a half sister to those two dogs.
And is that, do you see that in them or weaker, or is it just him?
It's him. It's not them. It's just him.
Okay. Well, like I said, none of this is 100%, but it's hedging your bets. You know, we're playing by some rules that will, you know, two step forward, one step back. Sometimes it's still progress. And that's what I'm saying is, like, I would look at it and given your, there's always some risk, especially how small you would be in your breeding program. That, you know, you've got to make the best guess. It's not going to be perfect, but it's calculated. And you're going, he's a one-off. I don't see this anywhere else. You know, this is possibly an experience issue that happened in development, but then you could go the risk of it not being because he's really bad about it. You got to weigh those things out. And that's where your experience in your world, you know, I probably can't allude to on that and make a decision.
Yeah. And I had then kind of wrote, you know, like you said, I mean, wrote down that this year, this is something I'm going to pay attention to. Does he get better with it or does it continue to be the same? So that's something I'm going to monitor with him.
So, just let me ask you, in your world, I mean, we can go on forever about this, but in your world, what I've noticed is some of these dogs are completely fearless and extreme reward, you know, performance is just off the charts. And they, you know, we say bomb proof, never seen this dog flinch at anything. Do you think about dogs maybe you've had like that, like never once had a problem. He's perfect. Never issued fear of anything, you know, all this when it comes to, you know, his hunting. In my world, we're starting to see that I don't trust that. Those dogs are bound to implode. I like a dog that sees things and reacts and experiences them and learns from it, and it's a good experience. Those dogs that never see anything, never flinch, never expose it, they are a ticking time bomb.
We call them kamikazes.
There you go.
Yep. And you're right. Bart, I didn't realize some of this stuff until I really got heavy into the police training, that I'm okay with a dog that watches and learns and eases into it. I don't have to have that dog.
It has a reaction. You go, yeah, that makes sense, you know, but you're okay.
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're right. The recovery is important, which you talked about. I mean, that's huge. But, I think two things, too, that I kind of want to hit on real quick is, all right, so one thing we did with this, both litters, we have all the pups. And when I say we, our group, out of the first litter, there was 9 pups, and we have them all within arm's reach. So we know what they're all doing. There's no question. Mm-hmm. We know the exposure. Like you said, if the dog's not given the training and the opportunity, how do you even know what you have? And the second litter, the same thing is I have my hands on all 6 of them. They're right here with us. In fact, I've kept 3. I ended up with 3 of the 6. And that way we can monitor this stuff and we can see what's going to go on. We're going to be able to log and, like you do, you know, jot this data down as these pups grow. And we'll know when we have a litter and that pup out of that litter shows something. We'll say, oh, yeah, that dog right there has that.
Yeah, and it's as simple as saying, like, what is your traits that you're looking for? It's not have to be any scientific thing. Like, this is what I say is the unicorn of a hunting dog, right, or your hound dog. And then say, where do they land? And track it and say, hey, am I making progress? But, like, I hear that you're making progress and you're showing this genetic. And now you're wanting to see if you can get consistency with it and then figure out where else do you want to make a push and progress, right? You've moved forward. And you want to stabilize and then figure out where you want to push. And you may already know where you want to push, and that helps out even more.
I mean, I know. I mean, for me, and everybody wants something, and it depends on what part of the country you're hunting in, too. I mean, you know, dogs.
What's the number one reason that you got your hounds, in just generally in the hound world, that a dog, what we call wash? What is the number one factor of concern?
I won't say what I think out loud, but.
Come on. That's what we do as dog trainers. You say things that people don't like.
I'll
talk about males and shepherds have artificial hunt given their background, and that upsets some people, but it's fine.
Well, I mean, again, we've got so many little tasks that we're asking the dog to perform, and being able to put 6 of those tasks together is, like you said, it's hard. I do think that, and before canine come into my world, I would say that the dogs are just genetically not strong. I feel like now half of it is our fault. It's the training.
Yeah, exactly. Not knowing how to work with it. Like, looking back, you're like, why did I do all that way?
Yeah, so many mistakes.
I mean, those must have been some good dogs back in the day because they just somehow figured out what the heck I wanted to do and what I'm doing me. sink or swim.
Yeah, and that's how it was. And so I think half of it is our training or problems that we create. And then the other half of it is our breeding. I think some of your comp guys are really trying to breed better dogs because they're wanting the competition dog. But when you get into the big game hound part of it, you know, I don't know. I think the breeding program is, all right, you're my buddy. I've got a good male in my book, and you've got a good female in your book, and we go breed them. And just what you said, I'm seeing it more and more, is that your female was 1 out of 10 that ended up doing something. My male was 1 out of 3 or 3 out of 10 that actually done something. So genetically, we're asking the dogs to do something that's probably not going to happen.
Yeah, the random of that roll of the dice and everything lining up, the odds of that are not good. You didn't set yourself up odds in favor for getting what you want genetically to work with you.
Yeah.
Just because that dog's good and I got a good dog and now we're going to put them together. That's what I cannot stand to see. It doesn't matter if it's a pet or whatever. It's just people breeding dogs. And, you know, in the competition world, we have it in labs and everything. It serves that purpose of giving you consistent people tracking pedigrees, medical, what they're doing. But also the competition world is not really realistic in a lot of ways to what I'm looking for. It helps me. It tells me what I can get. But, I mean, if you go see a field trial or a hunt test, I mean, I'm sitting here going, man, I've been duck hunting before. They are way over contemplating all this stuff. Like, why does he got to go get that one first? I don't understand. You know, you would do none of this realistic hunting. And you wouldn't do your coon dogs if you're actually hunting them. You know, most competition dogs, hunt test dogs, they can't even hunt them because it would mess them up for the competitions.
Wow.
So, yes. So it helps heads of vets, but it's getting further and further disconnected and fancy competition and then so far removed. And I don't know if it's that way in your world, but it may be. I mean, I don't really know how you'd complicate a tree and something, how you'd face that and mess it up that they would like duck dog. But yeah,
I think, and you know, I'm kind of going out on a limb here that a lot of our comp guys, they want their dogs to get off solo, get deep, get lonely, and get treed. And dogs are pack animals. We know this. Mm-hmm. They operate in a pack. And if you do any research on the coyotes or the wolves, you know, you see how they hunt, you see how they operate. And they're training the dogs to not honor other dogs, which is genetically not in the dog. So they're forcing a training habit.
So it's just so make them stand out so you can pick them out, what they're doing.
Well, it's so, you know, it's, you know, I don't want my dog backing yours because if I back yours, I could have been out training a coon and getting more points.
Why am I going to honor you?
Yes.
The bird dog honor point. I'm going to leave that. He found that. I need to go find another one.
Right.
That way, because that's how the way the game's played. I got you.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and I mean, that's each to their own. I mean, but that's not pleasurable for me. I mean, I like to go hunting and do my thing, but
it's not practical. It's good for what you're doing, but yeah, that may not be a trait that's realistic to if you're actually on the ground hunting these dogs and doing it for recreation and want to go do that. It's, you know, I need to be able to run in with a pack. I don't care, you know?
So
that's interesting.
Yeah. So Bart, I know we've used a lot of your time, but I just want to go back and again, I want to recap a few things just so our listeners understand. And we didn't go over half. We didn't even go over a smidgen of what we could talk about.
It's one of these things. It's like I'm trying to tell my world and what we do and not, you know, my verbiage, my lingo for what we do and try to mesh both worlds. It's very hard. And like you said, is we could do this for 2 or 3 days about this. And I hope generally we've scratched the surface and I hope that, you know, what I've said made sense. And you know, we discussed this is the only way that I've seen that we've made real progress until someone can say we'll take genetic from a dog, pop it in and go, this dog has the genetic traits for this. This is all we can do. And this is all that's been done, but we can be better at it if we understand.
Yeah. And I want our guys listening to the Houndsman XP and listening to the journey, you know, we want to create a better hounds, better handlers, better trainers. And, you know, being able to talk to you is one way that I know to do this. So if we outcross, I'm just going to recap. Mm-hmm. If we outcross, we're looking for a veritable that will strengthen our dog. That's what we should be looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And if you're bottlenecking, you need some genetic diversity so you don't run in the realm of inbreeding.
Mm-hmm.
So while you're increasing genetic diversity, grab something you want.
Right. And you should write that down. You should say, what is it that I want? I want, mm-hmm. for me, for us, for Houndsman, I want track, tree, speed, grit. What am I looking for? And write it down.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You should know that recipe in your dog. And mm-hmm. don't think about good and bad all the time. Just think about the traits that are present in those dogs and at what level. And they're, you know, too much salt is too salty, but right balance of salt and pepper is just right. So, yes, all these things are good things, but complementary one another. And at what level do they make that perfect mm-hmm. dog? You know, I don't want this over aroused dog, but I need enough, man, that he'll keep going until he keeps going. You know, he'll never stop.
Mm-hmm.
But I want too much. So don't think of good or bad, just presence and absence of them and what makes the best one and know what that is.
All right. And for line breeding, mm-hmm. for line breeding would be, I know, and I have line bred for 20 some years and I still have that line, which is very weak mm-hmm. now. But for line breeding, am I looking for the same thing in outcross? Am I looking for those traits to complement each other, or am I looking for, and I guess it depends on what I'm looking for. Am I looking for more of a track dog? Am I looking for more of a speed? And I add those two dogs, or what am I looking for in the line?
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying is even in your line breeding, you can make progress. You can push the gas pedal on some traits and, you know, and enhance those within that. It's usually typically when I'm looking for something that's like, we're really weak here and I'm not getting that, or I won't get it quickly. It'll take me four generations to push that to where I want to be incrementally. But these other dogs over here got that trait through the roof, or two or three that I'm looking for. Let's throw them in there and we'll get variability, but there'll be one or two of those dogs that we push that envelope. Now I cross back and get consistency, hopefully, or within two generations. Now in two generations instead of four, I've captured the traits I wanted, and I have created consistency that those are distributed throughout a litter.
Yep. And what mm-hmm. instance would I inbreed? And for you, where would it put you to say that I would do this?
I am not a breeder. I'm the one that collects data and goes, this is what I'm seeing, this is what makes sense. And then mm-hmm. talking to some people who do this. But in breeding, I'm not going to say at any point that I would do that I know a situation I have. I have heard of certain working dogs mm-hmm. that have large breeding programs that when things went awry and they didn't want to lose whole lines, that they brought in dogs that were had a breeding inbreeding coefficient of 35%. And what that did was, what that dog is what you're going to be, was the genetics we put in that dog. They are very little genetic diversity creating those behaviors. So when you breed that dog, the chances of this dog that has in pairing of that high inbreeding coefficient of it can cancel out. So if you made a mistake and your bloodline and like you thought you made progress, you kept a this and now you're breeding like, oh, I've messed up. Second generation, it just went off the tracks, right? I've lost the older ones. I've got to fix this. That's where you would take, they use that as a tool to go, no, I can fix problems with this because this has everything we want, super high inbreeding, and you use that to fix the problems. I know that's done in certain realms of working dogs or large breeding programs,
mm-hmm.
But that's the only time I've ever heard of it being pushed that high.
Right.
I think 0.16 is about as high as we go in the inbreeding coefficient.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what would that be? Like, can you put that in?
Oh, gosh, Sam. Gosh, that would be – no, I couldn't. I would hate to – this is where I draw the line. I'm not an academic. I'm a dog trainer. I don't study this to that realm.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know how distant a relation that is. Is it, you know, niece, nephew, or you know,
right,
or further? But it also takes into account that – you know, I mean, I don't know if it's niece, nephew, or one out from that that would be 0.16. But I believe niece, nephew, you know, that level, or grand, you know, right. So you had a grand pup. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that falls in that 1.6 or 0.16 inbreeding coefficient, but I know that's our line, and that's someone else's job that has said that's the inbreeding coefficient line that we don't cross.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so
there's easy ways on the internet to look that up.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. We'll put that in the show notes to look it up. But all right, Bart. So give us three things to enhance our breeding program. If you were going to give us three tips, what are three things that you would tell us to help us have a breeding program that was successful?
Well, first off, I'd define what your dog is that you want for you. Say you hunt with it. Mm-hmm. You know, and like you said, everybody's different. But what is that recipe? If your dog is this perfect meal that you're looking for, this recipe, a chef making, what are the ingredients? You say, from my experience, this is what makes those dogs. All the dogs I've seen, this is what I'm really looking for. Like this good dog over here, hey, he did this. I want all that together in one. What is that? And then be able to objectively identify it. Evaluate dogs. Say, do that truly what it is? And when you see a dog has what it is, don't stop at him. Don't get excited and go, that's what I'm looking for. What's his litter mates? What's his brothers and sisters look like? Does he have pups? Do they have it? Or is it just everything around him junk and he's good? Then you got to go as hard as it is, as much as you like. You need to be calculating and go, nope. Everything suggests that is not real. That's not going to show up in genetics.
Mm-hmm.
Very low chance. So define it, be objective, what you're looking for, be objective in evaluating and do your work and see, is this genetic to the best of your ability, the dog you find to look for in breeding, male or female. And then think about how they're playing together, complementary, and just be structured. And I think through time of doing that, and you know, you're going to get consistency, you're going to see progress, and you know, there may be mistakes, but those mistakes will tell you what's being thrown and what's not when they are, because they're going to mess up. I mean, we've made big mistakes. Like I've bred things and only had two litters sell. Like the Dutch Drawdyer across the lab, the F1 generation, best dogs I've ever seen. Second generation, ooh, this is bad. Third generation, all environment wind sound.
Yep. So
I could not sell any.
So it skipped a generation.
You're going to make.
Yep.
Yep. It was that hybrid vigor. Mm-hmm. Cross was great, but you lost it. You lost it. Heterosis. You lost it after that. So, you know, you're going to make those mistakes, but that's going to tell you that, you know, how's this being passed? And is this, these traits passed more on the female side, or they passed more on the male? You'll see that. I'll see it. I anecdotally say that I see things that are some more passed to the female side than the male side. And some things are more heritable than others. I can tell you that air scenting is highly heritable in dogs, and also elevation. Problems. Dogs that have elevated fear of heights.
Fear heights. Mm-hmm.
That is a major, major genetic thing which you wouldn't think about. So, find how these pass. So, just be structured and know what you're looking for, those ingredients, and be objective as much as you can. Do your homework and make mistakes and learn from them and move on.
Don't just
willy-nilly breed dogs together, because we tried that. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I think
a good dog to a good dog doesn't mean anything.
I think, unfortunately, a lot of us, I've been guilty of that, with not having a, you know, this is a good dog, this is a good dog, and breeding them and not really researching. And again, with my experience in police work now, I look at things a lot differently.
I mean, my brothers and sisters, they want to get dogs and buy pets. They do not call me. They're like, oh, no, we are not opening that can of worms.
Yes.
My sister is like, I'm getting a burner doodle. I just looked at her, and everybody was like, no, just let her whatever she wants to do. And I was like, okay. So. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Bart, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for sitting down and going over some of that with us. And, guys, I hope that this helps you in your breeding selection, your breeding process, and gives you some information that's going to make us better houndsmen. So, Bart.
Yes, and one thing that we can help with these resources you're going to put and stuff, I can put the selection paper of how we evaluate selected dogs to make progress and where we are and dogs going in the field and how we did that. Now, it's not your world, but you could take that paper and see how we did this.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to send it to me, I'll be glad to add it in the show notes and anything to help. Like I said, we're always trying to learn. And at the end of the podcast, we always end it with a saying. And Bart, I want to thank you for helping us find a way.
No problem. Thanks for having me on here. Appreciate it.
That's going to be a wrap for this week's episode of Creekside Chronicles. We appreciate you spending your time with us. Whether you're in the truck, in the woods, or sitting by the creek just listening along, thank you for walking this trail with us. And we got to say thank you to W Supply for hosting the podcast and supporting everything we do. Be sure to check them out and go to WSupply.com for all your hound hunting needs. Until next time, keep your dogs fed right, those leads tight, boots muddy, and we'll see you at the tree.
Tailgate drops before the light, coolers packed and the rig sitting right, tracking collars charged, beeping green, boots in the bed and the rifles clean. Dog box rattling, engines hum, we're chasing bear till the day is done. Old Ring barking like he knows what's near, nose to the wind, tail full of cheer. From the Virginia mountains to the Carolina clay, we're burning fuel and miles each day. Every turn's another tale, through mountain mist and paper trails, we see the sunset red in Tennessee. Rise through the fog in old WV, North Carolina's pines echo loud with the cry of a hard-run hound. New York forest, Maine's deep snow, Vermont valley's where the black bears go. Truck keeps rolling, wheels don't care, we're chasing daylight, chasing bears. Rest stops few, the roads are long, but the fire in our hearts still burns strong. Wisconsin mornings cutting crisp and clear, Canada's wildwoods drawing near. Still got states we ain't run, but that hound dog fever won't let us quit. We see the sunset red in Tennessee, rise through the fog. Chasing bear. Gas station coffee, Alpha XL on the dash. Another back road, another bear track. Friends made fast and stories told slow. Under stars where only hunters go. We see the sunrise gold in Canadian air. And it sets on a trail down in Appalachia. Packing steel and leather, grit and care. We're built for the road and chasing bear. So load the dogs and slam the gate. There's a trail ahead, we won't be late. From dawn to dusk, we're always there. Chasing daylight, chasing them bears.